The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On the show this week...
You're the kind of person who's willing to get into fights. You're the kind of person who's willing to cheat. And in some cases, you know, you're the kind of person who's willing to take drugs in order to get ahead.
Author Michael Brooks will be spilling the beans on the more rock and roll side of scientific discovery. And...
Like some people, as I went into high school, I sort of fell out of the dinosaur phase a little bit, mostly because I was living in New Jersey. And, you know, my parents and some other people told me, you can't be a paleontologist and live in New Jersey. There are no dinosaurs here. It turns out they were wrong, but I didn't really know that.
From stones to bones, Brian Sweetek will be discovering why paleontology just gets better and better. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The word science commonly evokes an image of the sterile lab, composed and methodical figures calmly gathering evidence and dispassionately testing theories in a selfless dedication to humanity. But for my next guest, this is at best mistaken, and at worst, a deception to mask the more dangerous or courageous aspects of science. Michael Brooks is a science journalist and author, and his latest book, Free Radicals, is an attempt to sweep the simplistic portrayal of science away and replace it with a morally ambiguous, more interesting image. I'm delighted that Michael Brooks is joining me in the studio today. It's great to have you on Science Weekly, Michael.
Hello.
In your book, you talk about the portrayal of science, particularly post-war, as quite a sort of meek and slightly boring subject. And the whole book seems to be a lot about why that's wrong. Tell us what's really going on.
Well, what's really going on is that scientists, in order to make a breakthrough, you know, you have to defeat the old guard, you have to present a new idea, and then you have to defend it to the hilt, and you have to prove it in experiments. So actually, it's pretty tough to do science, and that's not really been sort of let out of the bag, as it were. And so to be that tough, you have to be creative, you have to be the kind of person who's willing to, you know, change people's worldview, which also means you're the kind of person who's willing to get into fights. You're the kind of person who's willing to almost, you know, to cheat in order to prove your point, you know, to shortcut the system, as it were. Francis Crick was very good at that. And in some cases, you know, you're the kind of person who's willing to take drugs in order to get ahead. You know, there's all kinds of things going on that we don't really hear an awful lot about.
All kind of bad behaviour. So tell us a bit about the best examples of bad behaviour. What did Francis Crick do?
Well, I mean, Francis Crick, it emerged this year when some letters were published, stole data from Maurice Wilkins and Rosalind Franklin.
This is while he was looking at the structure of DNA up with the double helix.
That's right. So he was desperate for some data, and Linus Pauling was closing in on the structure of DNA, and Wilkins and Franklin were kind of shimmying around with their data in their lab in London and not releasing it. And Crick stole it. And he sort of later apologized and said, but, you know, really, you ought to get your act together, you know. And then, you know, he also sort of criticized Franklin for not taking the shortcuts that were necessary to do. So, I mean, he's a great example. Carrie Mullis is another sort of classic example of a Nobel Prize winner who trained his mind using LSD. You know, he manufactured his own psychedelic drugs in order to, as he put it, get down there with the molecules and understand what was going on.
And go and see what might be going on with the polymerase chain reaction.
That's right, yeah. So he found a way to copy DNA, reducing the process from months to hours. And he puts it entirely down to the fact that, you know, he had trained his mind to think in a different way using LSD.
So tell me a bit, because you talk about brand at the beginning of the book and about kind of, it seemed quite a powerful idea to think of this sort of, that you're used to having brand applied to, you know, commodities or to companies or to things like that, but to think of branding for an entire sector of society or an entire sector of endeavour is quite bold.
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, I talk about brand science as a post-war creation. So after the war, people didn't like science and they feared science. There's an amazing paper written by Jacob Bronowski in 1956 in which he says, people hate scientists. There's no use beating about the bush here. And what had happened was the V2 rockets had rained down on London, and they were a creation of science. We had the atomic bomb and the threat of destruction. There were, you know, stories leaking out of nerve gas tests and mustard gas tests on Allied soldiers. Of course, we'd known about the, you know, Nazi science that was being done. Science was this actually quite terrifying thing, and also at the same time, it's incredibly powerful. So governments were investing in science, and the kind of creation of the academic scientist was really a post-war thing. That it became this secure career. It became somewhere you could, you know, stay for life and get a good pension and a good salary. But in order to do that, scientists had to kind of have this complicity with the establishment, where they would promise to kind of, you know, look like they were behaving themselves. And the public image of scientists was very specifically molded. And there are exchanges between the Royal Society, for instance, and the BBC about how they wanted science covered on television. And they would release certain academics to the BBC and put them at their disposal, scientists, and put the labs at the disposal, as long as the treatment was of the kind of sort of respectable science that they wanted to see.
Respectable, white-coated, non-threatening.
There are actually memos. Yeah, that's right. There are memos saying, you know, can we just drop this angle of what, you know, the fearful consequences of science might be, and move on to, you know, looking at how the scientific method has improved everyone's lives. You know, it's an extraordinary kind of period in scientific history.
But so to get onto this idea of scientific method, because obviously that lies at the heart of all of this, you bring up Feyerabend, and you bring up other people who are looking at methodology in different ways. You have a sort of a thesis that all these guys are kind of, they're a bit anarchic. They're kind of, sometimes you have to fight to get your stuff through. Sometimes you have to kind of slightly fudge it and present it in a particular way. That makes it sound like you think that there is a sort of overarching drive towards truth that will get there eventually. So it sort of doesn't matter. You have these, you know, slightly anarchic people who fudge things, but eventually you will end up with the truth. How does that actually work?
Well, every scientist knows that you're not going to get away with it forever. You know, if you cheat, you know, if you don't have the data, somebody else will come along and try and replicate your experiment, and they won't be able to. So you know that, you know, you can't just make stuff up. You know, science is incredibly good at self-policing. And that's one of the, you know, I think it's probably its biggest strength, is that over the years, you know, science sets like concrete. You know, we still believe that the Earth goes around the sun now, you know, even though at the time Galileo did have to fudge his argument slightly. And I think it's really important to realize that data doesn't always come in clean. You know, scientists talk as if, in public this is, they talk as if, oh, you know, we just have a hypothesis and then we do the experiment and then the data tells us the answer. Now, you know, that's a lovely idea. It's not actually how it really works. And there are countless examples, and every working scientist knows that that's not how it works and that actually it's very hard to do. There was an incredible paper, I think it was released in 2005, where people talked about their experiences of doing science and whether they committed fraud, and, you know, as defined as kind of fudging data or ignoring data points that were you know, inconvenient, shall we say. And about a third of scientists admitted that, yes, this is kind of what they do, but you have to, because it doesn't work out like that. And there are these great kind of conversations that they had, and they said, well, we just knew that result was wrong, so we just ignored it. And in fact, the paper is called Normal Misbehavior, because that's how scientists describe, you know, this process of trying to get to the truth. But, you know, the path to the truth is actually sometimes a very long and winding one.
I was fascinated by the bit in the book where you talk about the way that the prion evidence was presented. And you contrast that with the way that one is taught in school in science lessons to present in the passive voice, in a kind of like, and this was done and this was discovered and this was concluded. Tell us a bit about how the prion research was, or how one can use language to present research.
This was, I think, probably one of my favourite discoveries in researching the book, is that there was an English professor at Butler University in the States called Carol Reeves, who did an analysis of Stanley Prusiner's papers about the prion hypothesis and what, you know, how he presented his research. And she showed that people were just bamboozled by the way he wrote his papers into believing that he'd solved everything. You know, and this is a highly controversial, still is actually quite a controversial idea, that all these diseases, CJD and Scrapie and BSE, come from this thing called a prion. Because Prusiner never really properly defined what a prion was. He kind of said, you know, it's this thing, but I've never actually said what it is. So if I'm wrong, you can't pin it on me. And it's really fascinating to look at. But I mean, the general opinion is now that he is right, and there is this thing called a prion that we need to look at. There's a protein that's involved in these diseases, and we kind of need to look for it properly. So he kind of provided a unifying principle, but he kind of won a Nobel Prize for providing a unifying principle rather than actually making a specific discovery, which is why people were so outraged outraged when he got his Nobel Prize, and you know, his competitors were issuing press releases, and half his lab had already left because they just couldn't believe the way that he was doing this. And you know, he was talking to a journalist and said, you know, prion, it's such a snappy word, it's fantastic, you know, people get loads of bad words thrown away, this one will last, kind of thing, you know. as if his major discovery was actually, you know, English.
Just a snappy word.
Yeah, but presentation matters a lot. There's been many discoveries in science where they haven't been properly presented and promoted, and thus they've taken, obviously, you know, they've eventually come in and become, you know, accepted, but in some cases decades have passed because scientists were actually almost afraid to kind of promote their work and present it in a persuasive way. You know, there was this kind of, we must sit back and just let everyone else decide. And so the you know, there's various discoveries, I would say, in science that sort of been held back for decades because people weren't prepared to be, you know, as anarchic as Stanley Prusiner was.
Like what?
There was one in the 1940s, this 1930s actually, Oswald Avery kind of discovered that proteins could encode, nucleic acids could encode information, which was a kind of precursor to Crick and Watson discovering the structure of DNA. You know, Crick had this thing that he called the sequence hypothesis, where the sequence of the nucleotides would tell you, you know, what this gene was going to do. And that was actually just kind of glossed over and completely ignored, this discovery, for decades, really, partly because the lab director was involved in a fight with somebody else at the time, so he didn't really sort of put any energy into it.
So if it's all about the presentation and about the fudging and the... It sounds like it's all a bit of a con. Do you respect the people who do it?
That's kind of the beauty of science, is that actually having discovered all of this, I actually respect science and scientists even more than I did. I kind of almost fallen back in love with science again, having seen how fantastically creative it is. How, you know, for me, it just kind of puts rock and roll to shame in a sense. You know, you've got this these amazing people who have to work with such incredible strictures, and then they have to come out and kind of defend all their work. And it stands up, and it's got to stand the test of time. So although, you know, you could argue that I'm kind of airing the dirty linen of science, if you like, I don't think any of this is anything to be ashamed of. I think this is part of, you know, a creative, very human process. And scientists just seem all the more impressive to me after kind of researching this.
Michael Brooks, thank you very much for coming on our podcast.
Thank you.
A huge thanks to Michael Brooks. And Free Radicals is published by Profile Books and available in all good bookshops, including the Guardian online bookshop. Just go to guardianbookshop.co.uk. News Jack. Now it's time to catch up with some of the big science news stories this week. I'm joined by The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. Welcome to the pod, Robin.
Thank you.
So what's going on with the UK in space this week, Robin?
Yes, it's the opening of the UK Space Conference, National Space Conference in Coventry today. It's, you know, this is the place where we kind of Britain puts its all its wares on the stalls and says, this is how good we are in space. And so the surprising thing is, having looked at it, we're not bad at space at all. The latest estimates suggest that space industries are worth about £7.5 billion a year to the national economy, which is quite something, and an employer of about 25,000 people. So we may not have many astronauts up there or many rockets being launched into space, but we have a lot of companies such as Surrey Satellites and others who are building very compact, very high-tech satellites that are being sold around the world. We've just sold a three to China recently. I haven't actually sold them physically, but we've taken an order for three from China recently. And there are lots and lots of examples like that. 15 satellites to be built for the European Galileo navigation system. So we, in many senses, doing well.
But all of that requires investment in research and investment in that kind of technological area, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think that's probably the worry, is if you look at the amounts of money that the French government, the Italian government, the German governments give to their space industries, it's substantially more than the UK industry. Our industry, in fact, has done very well on very, very scant support from the government. Now, the government has said it wants, by the year 2030, to have increased that turnover from 7.5 billion to 30 billion. That's an incredible chunk of money. And it's no point in just sort of saying, well, we expect that and we want that. They're going to have to dig up some wonga and, you know, find ways to promote these things.
Can we expect that kind of investment, the level of investment to create that?
That's a very good question. And I think there'll be some very earnest questioning at the conference in Coventry. You know, there are many very exciting projects we're thinking about. For instance, there's the Skylon rocket, reusable space plane that's been developed by Alan Bonds at Reaction Engines, and which follows on from the failed HOTOL project of the 1990s. Now, he says he has been supported by government very well and is hopeful that by the end of this decade, his space plane will be flying. And that will be wonderful. But there's a lot of buts and ifs and a lot of help that's going to be needed for him down the way. And not every sign is that comforting. One example that worries delegates is the closure of Kinetics laboratories in Malvern, which have been, at least if not closed, severely curtailed. And there was lots of expertise in there in optics and all these sciences that are very, very good for building satellites. Kinetic is the privatised laboratories of the MOD. Kinetic decided it didn't want to be in this field and just shut it down. And, you know, a great chunk of expertise in British science was lost. And that worries space scientists if something like that is out of their control and can go on.
You can read Robin's detailed exposition of that online at theobserver.co.uk. And looking at other government research services, we heard last week about the plans for the Forensic Science Service. Robin, tell us a bit about this.
Well, this is the Forensic Science Service. It's the place where you send your DNA samples when you want to investigate a crime. The government, about a year ago, said it wanted to privatise it, but the House of Commons Select Committee on Science and Technology last week heavily criticised it and condemned the plans as rushed. And if we think about the example of the privatising and the effect of what happened at Kinetic, you can see exactly why they're worried. This is an important national service, not something to be tinkered with and, you know, sold about like a loaf of bread.
So there's worries about ongoing cases, are there?
It's not so much the ongoing cases. It's the future of it. Who will handle future DNA investigations and other investigations, and who will ensure that Britain, which has a very, very strong lead in the subject, maintains that lead when it's a privatised enterprise?
And how about then the other thing that seems to come up is worries about the specimens that have been archived at the Forensic Science Services that are key to reopening cold cases.
Yes, I mean, this is always a problem, but I think that's more an ethical issue about whether, if you have not been convicted of a crime or charged with a crime, but your DNA has been kept, should that be allowed to remain on file? The previous government was very, I don't know, militaristic about it. It said you could. There are better signs from this government that really that's not quite justifiable.
And now on to something a little bit lighter or a little bit more fun, which foreshadows our next guest, Brian Switek, in that it's about using X-rays to find what colour dinosaurs were. It's the old question. Were they pink and purple, or were they brown and cream? Actually, seriously, it's about a new technique that is a way to get at and to study the tiny residual parts of pigment in dinosaur fossils. So, in recent years, scientists have used scanning electron microscopes to find very tiny melanosomes, which are the little tiny packages within cells that contain pigment. They can find spherical ones, which probably were reddish-brown, and they can find oval ones, which they interpret as probably being sort of dark black or brown. But in order to be able to scan these and find these little melanosomes, you have to chip away at the fossils. So recently, they've used much more powerful X-rays generated by a synchrotron to scan a whole fossil. So you don't need to chip bits off of it, you can scan the whole thing, and you can actually pick up on minute amounts of elements that stick around even after the melanosomes have degraded. So they found some copper, which they think indicates some dark pigment, and they have tried to work out whether they think that's there because it's part of the keratin that makes up, say, the feather, or whether it's there really to show that there was as part of a sort of pigment sac. It's part of the amazing progress that I think paleontology is seeing with being able to apply these kinds of techniques to get more information out of it. Did you like it,
Yeah,
Robin?
I thought it's fascinating. I mean, we're talking here about a bird that lived 120 million years ago. I mean, that's quite extraordinary to actually guess after all that period of time whether, you know, what colours it might... Not guess, I'm sorry, to make a very scientific estimate of what kind of colouring it had. I mean, we're a bit far short of finding out how, you know, whether it was a multicoloured kingfisher-type animal or... was it just an old black crow? But clearly, this work suggests, you know, it had dark and lighter patches, and, you know, was an interesting creature.
Thanks for joining us, Robin.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Robin McKee there. For Robin's writings, do pick up a copy of the Observer newspaper or find him online. And now for the Hannaford question.
I'm Tim Harford of the Financial Times, the author of Adapt, and my question's a technology question. I'd really like somebody to explain to me, in really simple terms, how it is that computers work. You know, from the ground up, I want to know how Windows works, I want to know how operating systems work, I want to know how do programmers do what they do. These are incredibly complex systems that we've grown very, very used to, and deep down, I have no idea how they actually operate.
Well, if computers seem a bit baffling and complex, the subject of paleontology shows the far greater complexity of fossils and evolution. Shedding some light on this is Brian Sweetek, who writes the hugely popular blog Laylaps and the Smithsonian's Dinosaur Tracking. His latest book is called Written in Stone: Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. It's an amazing survey of paleontological discoveries and delves into Brian's love of historical detail and why he believes we're about to head into a golden era of understanding and exploration. I spoke to him while he was in the US this week and started out by asking him why he'd taken that common teenage love of dinosaurs to such a level. Why do fossils float his boat?
Well, I guess it goes back to my first visit to the American Museum of Natural History in New York. When I was about 5 years old, my parents took me there for the first time, and I'd seen pictures and I'd seen a little bit of video on documentaries, but I'd never actually been there. And this was before they did their big renovation of the dinosaur halls in the late 90s, when the halls were still relatively dark and dusty, and the dinosaurs were all in their old sort of tail-dragging poses. But for my, you know, five-year-old self, it was absolutely stunning to stand below what was then called the Brontosaurus skeleton, look up at this thing and sort of imagine what it would have been like in life. And it was so quiet at the time, it wasn't a particularly busy day, where I sort of imagine this thing breathing, sort of almost like the ghosts of the dinosaurs sort of reaching across the depths of time. And that made a major impression on me. I'd already loved dinosaurs, but that really is what locked me in. And like some people, as I went into high school, I sort of fell out of the dinosaur phase a little bit, mostly because I was living in New Jersey. And, you know, my parents and some other people told me, you can't be a paleontologist and live in New Jersey. There are no dinosaurs here. It turns out they were wrong, but I didn't really know that. And when I went back to college, I took a Dinosaurs 101 course and a paleontology course. And the teachers were very, very supportive. And I did well enough where they started saying, well, why aren't you in this major? Why aren't you interested in paleontology? And I just kind of kept up with it from there. The more I dug into it, the more questions I had. And I've just been keeping up that sort of momentum. I just have so many questions that I want to find out the answers to that I just can't imagine diving into anything else.
That sort of that amazing curiosity drive comes across very well in your book Written in Stone. And in fact, I know you talk a bit about how you got into it in the last chapter. What was your vision for Written in Stone?
The book is sort of a tribute to what the fossil record can tell us about our place in nature, our place in evolutionary history. To some degree, it was a response to recent books like Richard Dawkins' The Greatest Show on Earth and Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne, in that those books usually contain one chapter on paleontology and about fossils. And most often the authors would talk about a few transitional forms, say like some of the amphibious whales that were whales with legs before whales became fully aquatic, or a few other fossils, and generally say, well, paleontology can show us that evolution is a fact, but it can't really tell us anything else. And then they go on to genetics or other sorts of observations. And I sort of felt that this was short-changing paleontology. Paleontology has really come of age and become, I think, the most interdisciplinary evolutionary science, where it's not just about collecting fossils and sticking them in a museum somewhere. Through new techniques and technologies, paleontologists are actually able to get at the biology of extinct organisms. We're able to actually start understanding how these animals lived, how they were related to each other, how these major events in evolutionary history happened. So I sort of wanted to tell that untold part of the story, that fossils aren't just these sort of relics that tell us evolution is true, that they are really fascinating objects that contain stories within stories that can tell us something meaningful about prehistoric life and how we fit into nature in general.
That is that seems to be the core of the book, is that detailed exposition. What's your favorite story in the book?
Yeah, although my favorite one, it sort of surprised me, because the person at the center of it was a bit of a huckster and a showman, and kind of took advantage of the fossils to make a bit of money. He was a German amateur paleontologist named Albert Koch, and he was working during the 1840s, and he had accumulated a few mastodon skeletons together to create this sort of super mastodon that he called the Missourium, and he ended up selling the bones to the what is now the Natural History Museum in London. And after he'd done that and made a bit of money, he kind of set his sights on the next big monster, his next big star attraction that he could put on tour, because at the time, these things were a major box office. You could draw people from miles around with prehistoric monsters that no one had ever seen before. So he got a tip that down in Alabama, there were sea monsters just waiting to be had on a bunch of plantations and farms. So he went down there, assembled all these fossil whale bones, and then kind of created this 115-foot-long sea monster that people just absolutely loved. This was like the height of the sea monster craze, when people said they were seeing them off the coast of Massachusetts, and naturalists were getting all kinds of letters and questions about what these things might be. So he took a real fossil animal, this whale that we now know is sort of important to understanding how whales became adapted to life in the sea, and he created a sea monster out of this thing. And even though the naturalists of his era recognized all his mistakes and came out with these reports and wrote editorials, they just couldn't quite stop this sensationalism surrounding this sea monster.
So tell me a bit about paleontology as a whole, because it looks like there may be kind of an image problem being developed for it if we're looking at sort of increasing sensationalization of it. But I know that you also talk in your book about the kind of exciting synthesis of paleontology and biology, of the study of living creatures, and the kind of, you mm-hmm. talked about it as a real interdisciplinary subject now. Where do you see it going?
It's always difficult to guess where the future of a discipline might be, but one of the areas of research that I find most fascinating in paleontology is the ability to start understanding how major transformations in the history of life happened by combining information from fossils with information that we're getting from studies of development and genetics and biochemistry, things of that nature. Hox genes, especially these regulatory genes that, if almost act like switches that control other genes during the development of an organism. You manipulate them, you might grow a hand or not grow a hand, or grow an extra hand, or have a tail or not have a tail, have teeth or not have a teeth. These genes that seem to have major potential to explain how some of major transformations in the history of life happened, how whales lost their legs, how birds lost their teeth. I think that is a really fascinating aspect of interdisciplinary paleontology as it is now, and also just really wonderful discoveries that answer questions that we've always had that have never been able to answer, like dinosaur feather colors. I think in 2010, that was one of the top science stories for me, is that paleontologists are now able to zoom in at such a fine level to preserved feathers on feathered dinosaurs and see these microscopic bodies that correspond to pigmentation in the feathers. You can compare the feathers of feathered dinosaurs to the feathers of modern-day birds, their descendants, and get some idea of what color dinosaurs actually were. And I remember, you know, reading in, you know, almost every book about dinosaurs as a kid, we'll never be able to tell what color dinosaurs were. Now we finally have the technology to do that.
It's wonderful. It's extraordinary to think what might be achieved when you start adding in those kind of those discoveries from genetics or from technology or from anything else. Brian, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. The book is wonderful. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Brian Sweetek's Written in Stone is published by Bellevue Literary Press, and for more information, just go to his website, briansweetek.com. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Nell Bowes, and Science Weekly's producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye for now. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.